Hey folks, we're sponsored today by NatureBox. NatureBox is a monthly subscription service that delivers better snacks straight to you. These are the kind of snacks you can feel good about. No high fructose corn syrup, no hydrogenated oils, no artificial flavors or colors. Smarter snacks, my friends. Go to naturebox.com/WTF to get 50% off your first box. All NatureBox snacks are nutritionist approved. They're wholesome, delicious, and delivered right to your face. Go to naturebox.com/WTF today for 50% off.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuck nicks, what the fuckadelics, what the fuckleberry fins, what the fuck is sugarness? Bah. Now I'm just making noises. Hi, this is Mark Maron. You're listening to WTF, my podcast. I'm once again, just by virtue of the sheer art of it, broadcasting naked from my garage. I'm naked in my garage wearing only a hat, a toque. A toque, is that what you call it? It's a fan-knitted toque I am wearing beneath my headphones, and that is all I am wearing. I'm not trying to be titillating. I'm trying to be open, man. I'm trying to be as raw as possible in the sense of how does it make me feel? What am I feeling right now? What is Mark feeling when he sits naked in his garage? Because I got to walk across the little area there naked, so that's something. It's invigorating. I'm hoping it has an effect, only if anything, on me. On the show today, Simon Amstel, a British comedian who I saw a while back over at the Largo, Flanagan's place, and I thought this guy seems a little uncomfortable, a little squirmy. I'd like to talk to him. I think we might have some things in common, me and this Amstel kid, and I had a lovely chat, and it covers a lot of things that in a different way than I've talked about before. British Jew, that always fascinates me. I don't know why. Before I forget, okay, yeah, don't forget, my special Thinky Pain, an hour and a half of Mark Maron comedy, is now available at Amazon and other places where you buy DVDs, so go get that. I'm proud of it. You'll enjoy it. It's a little Tom Sharpling cameo, a little Sam Lipsight cameo. It was an amazing night, and if you don't know me, you'll get to know me. If you know me, you'll know some of where I'm coming from. Get it. Get the special. Because it's an hour and a half, and now I got to start from scratch and figure out what is going on in my life that is funny. Moving on. My brain was a little dinged up last night. I went to a modern dance performance. Yes, my friend Moon took me to a modern dance performance with a 9-year-old girl and an 8-year-old girl. And I don't get much time. I don't spend a lot of time with kids because I don't got any. And then the brother's kids are over there in Arizona. There's only so much I can do, but it was quite something. The modern dance business. I guess he was a pretty important guy, Wayne McGregor Random Dance. The performance was far. And it was down at the Royce Hall. Look, there's nothing we can do. This stuff is going on all around us. There are people committing their lives to dance. And it's easy to condescend. It's easy to dismiss. But it is something, man. I'm not sure how to watch it. I'm not sure how to take it in. But there is some skill and some rawness and some electricity and just physical, like, awesomeness in the modern dance stuff. I don't know what I'm looking at, but I know, like, the lights come down, people come out, they're jerking around, they're dancing, they're jumping up and down through the air, their bodies look beautiful, and I squirt out a few tears right away. What is that? Just a couple of people come out dancing and I'm squirting out tears because I guess I'm moved by the humanity of it, by the humility of it. Just bending around, flying through the air, twisting, contorting, touching each other, doing things with each other, you know, like back and forth stuff. And then some other people come out, then a few other people. My brain's kind of bending to sort of find narrative in it. It's like, oh, she with that guy? I don't think she should be with that guy. Oh, there's another guy. Oh, the three of them together? Now what's the problem? Seems like someone's upset. He just ran over to the other side of the stage. Oh, who are these people?
Wow. Oh, they're doing that. Look at them moving around, moving around, moving around. Now a little walking, a little moving around. So who's with who? What's going on? What's the story here? Oh, everyone's laying down now. Oh my God. Look at that guy. How the hell did he do that? He picked her up. She's in the air. Oh, I don't understand what's happening, but it was pretty fascinating. It's very, it's a beautiful art form, but I never go. Do you guys go? Do you ever think like, let's go to see some modern dance? I think it's one of those things where you're like, I don't know. Usually it's like, it's almost like a traumatic experience from college. Yeah, I got dragged to one by this woman in college and, nope, not going back. I think that was the second time in my life that I sat down for a modern dance performance. And it's important. It's an important art form, dance. It's not unlike when I went to the opera or perhaps to the symphony, where it's this organic human thing. You can hear, you know, the feet scuttling on the ground. You can hear when they touch each other. And this particular performance had a lot to do with like jerky movement. I don't know if it's the crunking or the twerking that has made its way into modern dance, because I don't keep up. I'm not on the mailing list as to what's being integrated from the streets into the vernacular of modern dance. But I do have to say it was very impressive. All in all, I was very happy I went because it was enriching. It enriched me in the sense that it's like, oh my God, this is a way of expressing yourself. This is something people do and it's amazing. I just don't make time in my day for the arts. And I think it's important as we drift further and further away from the vessels that we are. It's important to go witness a bunch of sort of, a bunch of meat puppets dancing around, playing instruments and stuff. That's not just rock and roll. Good stuff. Good stuff. Still naked. Hey, I don't know if you know this, but postage rates went up today, people. Did you forget to go out and load up on forever stamps? Do you need to get those little 3-cent stamps because of all the old stamps you have laying around? If you were using stamps.com like I do, you wouldn't have to worry about all that. With stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage right from your desk using your own computer and printer. You can do it naked. And Stamps.com always updates the postage rates for you automatically, and they don't charge a fee to do it, unlike those postage meter companies. So at Stamps.com, you'll always get the exact postage you need for any letter or package the instant you need it. You'll never have to go to the post office again, and you'll never have to worry when they change the rates. Right now, there's a special offer for you when you use my promo code WTF. Start a no-risk trial with a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and up to $55 of free postage. Don't worry, go to stamps.com, and before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in WTF. That's stamps.com. Enter WTF. So what else is happening? Today on the show, I talked to Simon Amstel, and we bring up Daniel Kitson, who is a British comedian who many of you may not know, but you should familiarize yourself with him if you can find something of his to look at. He's quite a genius. And quite an interesting, unique voice. And I just wanted to have you know that he is, not infamous, but, a mythical presence almost in British comedy, certainly. And some Americans know him in that he won't do my podcast. He doesn't do much TV. He doesn't like to record himself necessarily. He's an oddball that keeps it very pure. And, I just wanted to give you a point of reference. For when me and Simon start talking about him. That's who he is. Go see if you can find some stuff, that Daniel Kitson fella. What else do I got to tell you? Oh, well, Moon showed me an amazing thing, and I'm just going to hip you to this for those of you who are interested. I don't know what the hell chia seeds are all about. I don't know why people eat them. I don't know how people eat them. They don't taste good to me. I'm old enough to remember the Chia Pet, and that to me is what they were used for. But now everybody's eating them because, I don't know, somebody decided it was good and a bunch of other people decided to go along with it. If you get some coconut milk and you put it in a glass and then you fill it, one to four, that's what I did, you would go one to four chia seeds to coconut milk. And I used unsweetened coconut milk and I put a little stevia in there. So it's one part, the chia seeds, and then three parts coconut milk with a little sweetener in it if you're not using sweetened, and you put it in the fridge for like 6 hours or overnight, and you wake up and you have like coconut tapioca pudding, and it's fucking unbelievable. How simple is that? So needless to say, I think I've eaten my quota of chia seed for at least the week. But that's a good time thing to do right there if you want something to do. Also, tomorrow I am directing the final episode of Marin. I don't think it'll air as the final episode, but it's the final episode of my shooting of Marin at for IFC season 2. And I am directing. I'm very excited. I'm a little nervous, but I think I got a handle on it. And it's a very personal episode. So that's thrilling. And I also want to say that I got to be honest with you. Shooting the second season of my show for IFC was just great. It was a blast. We got a lot of great scripts. A lot of great people worked on the show. The crew was great. Everything was amazing. And I had a good time. I'm trying to keep that on the down low. I don't know why, but I had a great time. And I'm very proud of what we did there. I'll let you know how the directing goes. I'm a little nervous, but I got a powerful crew. We're working as a well-oiled machine. So someone will pick up the slack when I don't know how to say, can we get an over here? Or are we going to get coverage on both of those things? Can we hinge here? Where's the wedge? Okay, let's do the master. We're going to go in for close-ups. I've heard a lot of these things used, but I'm not exactly sure what they mean. So someone will clear that up for me, right? Won't they? Hey, are you having a Super Bowl party? You want to load up on some snacks that everyone can enjoy and feel good about? Well, you've still got some time to go over to Nature Box and get your snacks before the game. When you use Nature Box, you can get a box of delicious snacks delivered to you every month. Great snacks, smarter snacks, no high fructose corn syrup, no hydrogenated oils, no artificial flavors or colors. That's colors in French and Spanish, I believe. Each snack faces strict quality standards and their nutritionist improved. A nutritionist said, I approve of this. And you can't beat the convenience since they come right to your door or get them sent straight to your office. No more falling asleep at your desk because you binged on candy bars earlier in the day. Nature Box has dried fruits, whole wheat fig bars, all kinds of granola, savory or sweet. It's your choice, pals, people, folks, ladies. Or if you want it all, get a rotating surprise box each month. Different sizes are available, too, if it's just for you or if you want to get your family or coworkers onto better snacking. Feel good. Feel better about how you snack. Go to naturebox.com/WTF for 50% off your first box of goodies. It's time to get snacks that you can feel good about at naturebox.com/WTF today. 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 Let's talk to Simon Amstel, a British Jew. Hilarious guy.
So I was in Texas.
Yeah.
There's a man sat opposite me wearing a Marc Maron t-shirt.
Really?
Yes. And you and a cat.
Yeah.
And I say, how come you have a Marc Maron t-shirt?
Did you really?
Yes. He looks surprised that I know it's a Marc Maron t-shirt. I say it's because I'm a brilliant comedian.
Uh-huh.
And he says, you got him through his divorce.
What? You got him, like...
You got him through his divorce.
Oh, I've
been listening to this podcast. So, isn't that good to hear?
It's great to hear that. That's the service I'm providing
people.
There are people in pain, in trouble, and I think that the soothing tones of my trouble elevate them.
Your misery meant that his misery was a bit, you know, lessened.
Well, you're a little heavy-hearted, aren't you, in general?
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah. I mean, I saw you.
That's all I've got.
I saw your I saw Numb when you were here. I came to that.
Yeah,
at
I remember.
Largo.
Yeah.
And I immediately identified with you. I don't remember exactly what the show was about, but I remember thinking, like, I get this. I know exactly where he's coming from. It's difficult being as self-conscious and heady as we are and moving through the world without being or appearing self-conscious and heady. Do you have that issue?
Yeah, it's just tricky, isn't it? Most people just drink alcohol, so it's all right.
You never drank.
I tried it when I was younger. I just didn't like it.
Yeah, didn't stick.
No,
didn't take.
I tried drinking. I tried smoking. None of it felt
no
right.
No relief.
No, nothing. Nothing. The only thing I tried that I really liked, although I'd never really do it, is magic mushrooms.
Yeah?
I found those to be lovely.
How many times did you do that?
I don't know, like 3 times in my life.
Uh-huh.
And the first time I did it, I had a gig in the evening.
Yeah.
And I thought they'd sort of worn off.
Yeah, no.
But they were still there.
Yeah.
And it was around the time where I was still, you know, on the circuit for 5 years, where I was trying to figure out who I was, and I figured out that night who I was.
Did you remember it?
Yeah, and I thought, I can't take magic mushrooms every time I have to do a gig, but I can remember this feeling. There was a looseness, there was a funniness that I found, a freedom.
A lightheartedness, perhaps.
Yeah.
You just, so, and that was, you trace it to that moment?
I think so. I mean, apart from just doing it quite a lot, there was a feeling of, oh, this isn't important, or this isn't hard. This is like, this is just a group of people laughing. This is just joyful.
Yeah, there's nothing to be afraid of.
Yeah, nothing to be afraid of. And it was the same material, but suddenly I was like finding the... just the joy in it, I suppose. Just the joy.
Well, how old were you when you started doing stand-up?
Well, 13.
Yeah. At your bar mitzvah?
At my bar mitzvah. No, 13 it was the annual, variety show.
For real?
Of the drama club that I used to attend.
Okay. And you chose to do stand-up?
Yes. Did I kick you there?
That's okay.
I'm sorry.
It's all right.
We're so close.
Okay. Yeah, I know.
What was I saying? Oh, yeah. So I was a very shy child, and a teacher suggested that I go to a drama club to bring me out of my shell a bit.
Yeah.
And then I guess I really got into it because I asked if I could do some stand-up comedy at the show.
And had you seen stand-ups before?
I'd seen some like late night television, like some stuff in the Montreal Comedy Festival shown on Channel 4 in the UK.
Is that where they show it? Because I've done several of those tapings, but I don't know where they show it.
Everywhere apart from America, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So you saw some of that?
Yeah, and I don't know if it was just that I liked that it would just be me on the stage.
Probably.
But, you know, I really liked, I think I liked the idea of it. They looked silly. They looked fun, those people.
And they looked like they had control of the situation.
Yeah.
There's something, I remember seeing it when I was a kid. I'm like, that guy's got, he's in charge there.
But not in an alpha male way.
No,
that I could emulate, maybe.
Right.
Because they were so sort of, you know, they were, I don't know, that in that way that...
They were entertaining, you know, and they seemed to make people feel better.
Yeah, that's a nice thing to be able to do, isn't it?
Yeah, if it works. I don't think that was my specific agenda for half of my stand-up career. I'm not sure I was in it to make people feel better. I think I was actually in it to drag them down to the level I was at.
I don't know about you, but I think for me, the stuff that happens is purely coincidental and everything. Like, it's a purely selfish act.
Yeah.
Like, we're just doing it because we like doing it. And that the laughter is happening is good news. And that if anyone feels better because they relate to something, that's good news. But really just doing it because we like it, right?
I think so. I think that for me, I really think I got up there to find myself.
Oh yeah, I don't know if I'm thinking about that just in hindsight and having heard Seinfeld talking about it being a thing of self-discovery and I go, oh yeah, that is what it is. But,
I think that really because of what I grew up in, I don't know how you grew up, but we can talk about it, that my parents are very selfish.
Right.
So I think in order to sort of get attention, you know, I had to be fairly kind of like dramatic about things.
Okay.
And I think it was a way to get up on stage and like, I got something to say.
What do you mean by they were selfish?
They were very, you know, not great emotional boundaries. Like, I really don't look at my parents as parents as much as these people I grew up with that, you know, seemed to, you know, be around. You know, they were not very nurturing people. They were kind of self-involved.
Neither of them. Both self-involved.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yours?
I suppose my story about myself is that I was sort of the product of a divorce. So that first stand-up gig when I was 13, that happened in the same year that my parents divorced. So I think it might have been a diversion thing. I think I was trying to say, look, let's not be sad. Look, I'm doing this over here. So I think I'm still doing.
Oh, that's so to avoid pain.
Yeah, to make my mum laugh rather than carry on crying. Maybe a bit of that.
That's a tough age to experience that at, because you're aware.
Yeah.
You're coming into your own madness, whatever that is.
Exactly, yeah. I should have been just going through puberty.
Right, not dealing with...
Instead I was learning to do magic tricks and, and juggle.
And hide the tears.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Look, I'm juggling. I'm juggling clubs. Look.
I'm not crying.
Everything's
look, I'm not
fine.
Crying.
Look, I'm not dropping them. Please stop crying. I won't drop them.
The crying magician. That's a good angle.
Yeah.
So you grew up Jewish.
England. Only culturally, really, not religiously.
Me too.
The circumcision and the bar mitzvah.
Yeah. I think that's the same with most Jews. I think you just do your part. The first one you don't have any real control over.
Strange though, isn't it?
That they just cut a piece of your dick off?
Strange.
It is a little weird, isn't it?
Don't you think it's, I mean.
And then there's a guy there, there's a service, people come.
Yeah.
It's not like just at the hospital, you know, it's usually done at a home.
Yeah. Oh, there's a party.
Yeah, yeah.
I had a joke about they weren't even religious, you know, they cut off, like, the buffet wasn't even kosher.
Yeah,
like,
right.
We don't care about that bit, we just love the cock cutting.
Yeah, yeah.
That's our thing. You know, they did it because it was the convention of the people around them, because they thought we better cut off a bit of our child's penis, otherwise people will think we're weird.
Yeah, and so they'll be able to identify each other in the bathroom.
Yeah, so maybe a bit of that.
I don't know what the original reason was, but yeah, it is cultural, and everyone, you know, gets it. I think most people are circumcised than not.
In America, is everyone circumcised?
Well, it's not a law, but no. You can choose, parents can choose not to do it, but I think it's an option.
It's so strange.
I remember the first time I saw one that wasn't circumcised, and I found it sort of off-putting.
Well, I remember the first time I saw a vagina.
Yeah.
I just assumed that everyone had a penis.
Really? How old were you?
I was 25. Yeah. That's such an old joke.
Yeah, you had to.
You know, like, I was a kid in my garden, I think, and there was like the next door neighbor's, I don't know, girl child.
Yeah.
Like, what the hell is that? Why is...
What's she missing?
Yeah.
You just thought girls
had... She's all broken, that girl. Yeah.
But I noticed that, like, in your show...
Yeah.
Yeah, vagina's not your thing anyways.
No, but, you know, I accept them.
Sure. Well, that's good. That's good. There's a lot of them around. It's nice that you accept
them. Yeah, I came from one.
Yeah.
I'm into them, actually. Yeah. I'm really into them.
But the one thing I noticed about that's different, but the idea that you're gay was not the theme of the show. And you just, you didn't even really acknowledge it as anything to be like, and?
Yeah, it's not a thing.
Right.
Yeah.
And was that a conscious choice, though, to sort of not? Because, like, most gay comics that I've known, certainly American ones, I mean, that's their hook. They're gay.
I suppose when I first came out, it was something I was thinking about a lot, so I wrote about it.
Yeah.
But after that, I mean, it just hasn't been something that's really, doesn't do anything. You know, it's not
right.
It's not in my life. It's in my life, do I have a boyfriend or not?
Right.
You know, did something terrible happen when I was having sex or not? You
right.
know, it's not really... And I think, and to be more, you know, deep and adult about it, I suppose, I'm not really into any kind of label. I think comedy is the thing that can bring people together rather, you know, I'm not really into, and I don't like, you know, I don't like anything that's like, well, okay, so I'm a Jew and therefore something.
Right.
No, therefore.
Yeah.
You know, what about, you know, it's always a bit false.
Yeah.
It's always like, yeah, it sounds sort of funny. Oh, yeah, you're a Jew and therefore this. But actually, you could have said, I'm a human being and therefore this.
No, I think that's, self-stereotyping to culturally identify is kind of tedious.
And it feels like so, it's so easy and untrue at the same time. I watched a lot of Eddie Izzard when I was growing up.
Yeah.
And he's a transvestite. Who is not really talking about being a transvestite, and I quite like people who just happen to be the thing, and it isn't their career.
Yeah, but he did wear some spectacular outfits.
Yeah, but then didn't really go on about them.
No, I
you know. He comes out in the outfit, and then he's talking about Star Wars or whatever. You know,
it's a little Star jarring. Trek. So that had a big impact on you?
Yeah, I liked him a lot. I liked him, and I liked Bill Cosby a lot, and Roseanne, those sitcoms.
Yeah, Bill Cosby's great.
Mm, I saw him at the Montreal Festival.
You did? When?
2 hours. I don't know, what was it, three or four years ago?
Was it life-changing?
It was a bit.
Why?
I had to rush straight to my show from seeing his show.
Yeah.
And some of his Cosbiness stayed in me for my show, and it made me a bit better.
I had the same experience with him, watching him again later in life, that the sort of idea that you can really choose what's funny. Like, you know, you can...
Right, yeah.
There was something about him where it looks so effortless, and it doesn't seem like he's processing any sort of... Not even, it's not fear, but even structure in a way. He's just sort of like, I'm going to do this. I am who I am. I'm going to sit down and we're going to move through this.
Yeah. He didn't even want the applause at the beginning.
Oh, really?
He came on in this, you know, in like a tracksuit.
Yeah.
Sat on his chair and people were applauding like crazy because it's like this legendary man walking out and he's, you know, just like, you know.
Really?
Like, waving his hand, saying, please don't applaud. This is just ridiculous. Why would you? Come on. Let's not waste time.
Yeah.
He sits down. And, you know, then he just starts talking. Maybe fiddles with some tissues.
Uh-huh.
And then there was a bit about, like, five bits in where he suddenly just says, and this is the only bit I can remember. It's not funny, but it really made me go, wow, this guy has no fear.
Yeah.
He suddenly just said, the microphone level is about one notch too high. Can we bring it down one notch? So the microphone then gets lowered.
Yeah.
And he carries on. Doesn't make a joke about that. Doesn't say, carries on.
Right.
The microphone is too high.
But he does say it like Cosby. So you're already like,
But you think, is this going? Well, right. Is this... And there's
the
nothing.
The microphone.
Yeah. And so then when I did my show in Edinburgh a few years ago, the air conditioning was a bit loud. And I remembered Cosby.
Right.
And I said, can we turn... But even I had to do a joke after that. Like I had a fan on the stage and I said...
Because of the fear.
Because I was like, I can't just leave that in the air.
Yeah.
I can't just carry on with my story. But he had no fear. He could just keep going. Yeah.
So when you were 13,
yeah,
your parents get divorced. What did your dad do?
Dad ran a sort of courier company.
Yeah.
Yeah, or owned and ran
a courier company. Did you still get along with both of them after the...
Dad became the enemy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I've since sort of dealt with that. And obviously I sort of made that up. And
how old were you when you finally dealt with it?
24.
Wow. It's a long time, right?
Yeah, a long time to be sort of hating someone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you didn't see him when you were a kid either?
I did a bit, but I always found it quite boring, and I'd really, you know, bought into this story that he was the bad guy and that my mum was perfect.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, neither of those things are true.
Right.
It's nonsense.
Yeah, I'm going through a period right now with my father. I'm 50, and I'm not talking to him.
You're not talking to him?
No, I'm going to have to.
Go on, what's going on?
he got offended by my a book I wrote and a TV show because he was in it. You know, I characterized him.
Oh, yeah, I've done that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And
I always get annoyed. My dad doesn't get annoyed.
Oh, really?
I feel like, did you not see it? Why are you...
No response
say
at all?
Say something about it. I did it.
How did you handle it, though? Were you honest or did you throw him under the bus? Was there spite?
No, it was kind of, I think the reason that there's no anger about it from him, or if there is, he's not doing anything about it. I think what I'm always up to is coming from a place of self-discovery and just trying to, you know, just trying to figure things out.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, it's never coming from, right, I'm going to get you now.
Yeah.
I'm going to do that. Okay, now I'm going to tell him.
Right.
It's never that. So I think that it probably comes across that it's just me trying to figure out what's happened to me and why I am, how
right.
I am. And it's, I find it very healing, all the writing and the, you know, it brings me closer, I think, to him.
I think so. When I looked at my stuff, I had to kind of figure it out. Like, was there spite? Was there a bit of payback? You know, because when somebody's had an effect on your life, if it's negative, it becomes tricky to frame it. You know, obviously they're part of our lives and it is self-discovery, but you know, on some level you're saying, well, that guy kind of fucked me up.
Yeah.
I love him, I think, but you know, it's a problem.
What did you say about him? What was the bit that he wasn't keen on?
That, you know, he's manic, he's bipolar.
Uh-huh.
And like, you know, people know. I mean, you gotta be, you know, but he didn't want that many people to know.
Right.
And, a writer friend of mine, he said, like, what's his problem? But bipolar is like the new, it's like diabetes. Everybody's bipolar. Who cares, you know? But he's very selfish too. So like, he thought it was going to have some major implications on his life, but, he's emailing me again. So I think it's time to reach out eventually.
And so you're not talking to him?
Kinda. I mean, you know, I just didn't want to deal with it. I didn't want to deal with the negotiation. You know, the book was written. The show was made.
Mm-hmm.
There's no negotiating. You know, there's no sort of like what, you know, there's no conversation to be had other than it's happening. You know, prepare yourself.
Right.
For whatever.
Did you say that? Did you say prepare yourself?
Pretty much. I said, look, you know, I don't think, well, he was, he thought that something dramatic was going to happen in his life because of it. I don't think so. What'd you say about your dad?
Well, in the last stand-up show,
yeah,
I spoke about how
in Numb,
he I you know, I spoke about how sometimes it's, you know, it's hard going over to his house. It's, you know, it's not always fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't, and that we didn't talk for a while, not for any reason, just a sort of lack of joy, really.
Yeah.
And then he phones and says, you know, I've been thinking, and, you know, one day I'm going to be on my deathbed. And if we don't have this relationship, there'll be regret. And so now I make sure I, you know, see him once every month or two, and I always regret it. But then I, and this is the worst line I think I've ever said, I say, but you know, when he dies, I'm going to feel pretty good. And he didn't seem to mind that. That seemed to be all right.
He saw it?
Yeah, he didn't come to see it. You know, I think there are always moments with these people.
Where, these people we call parents?
Yeah, where you know, you forget that they've just got their own stuff going on to do with their parents.
Right.
And there was one time when he came to see a show.
Yeah.
I was really pleased he'd come to see the show because my mum comes to everything.
Right.
And she couldn't be more proud and too proud, and it's too much sometimes. And my dad, it's like, okay, come on, tell me I'm good. Just tell me something here.
Yeah.
And he came to the show, and there was like a little party thing afterwards, and he just like left very quickly. I was like, oh, fuck. I was like, what do I have to do? And sometimes, like, you know, after you've been on stage for an hour and a half, you think, how funny do I have to be, Father?
Yeah.
What do I have to do for you?
Yeah.
So he left, and I was like, okay, you know what? He came, it's fine. And then he emails the next day, and he says, I'm so proud that not only can you do that on stage, but that you're able to be so sociable afterwards at the party. And what I realise is that, because I was very shy as a child, I think he has the same shyness, but without going to the drama club.
Right.
And he's not leaving the party because he hates me or he can't, you know, it's because he can't be at a party.
Wow.
He's the same sort of awkward person. I learned that through writing Grandma's House, this sitcom that I made. I was doing a scene with this actor who was playing him, and you know, I didn't even know during the writing of this scene with my father and I what it was about him that I you know, struggled with. I realised it's that we're similar.
Right.
And it's with like the same idiot. That's the problem.
Right.
And so it's, you know, it's, I don't know what you're supposed to do with these people.
But I mean, that's an important realization.
Yeah.
Because you resent them because, you know, you have expectations of them that they're supposed
to be. It's the expectations. It's always the expectations. What I learned from writing this sitcom about my family is that, what I learned in terms of how you can be with your family at peace and completely content at some sort of family event is you have to go there and not expect them to be any different to how they were last time. Then it's fine.
Yeah. They're not going to change.
They're not going to. If they do, it won't be because of you. It won't be because you've tried to fix them. And, you know, that's what I mean, that was big.
Right.
I was like, oh, and then you find them funny. Then they're, oh, that's so funny that they're like that.
They're
how
just
ridiculous.
People.
They're just people.
Right.
And beyond that, just sperm.
Yeah.
They provided the sperm. So I'm here. What else do you want?
But I think the fight is really that there was some expectation earlier to be parented a certain way. So there's some part of you,
right.
if you do have some, like, resentment about it,
mm-hmm.
in how you were parented, there's that same part of you is expecting to be parented. And like that fucking ship has sailed.
It's
so,
gone.
Yeah.
It's gone.
So once you let that go, you realize, oh, you guys are just these people.
Yeah.
With weaknesses and character flaws and everything else. And I just have to accept you as that and take up the slack.
And then you can go to, if you can get Oprah enough on yourself.
Yeah.
Being grateful for exactly how they were.
How are you with that?
Yeah. I feel like I've got a pretty cool, fun life.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact that I started doing stand up when they divorced, I wouldn't be here. I mean, in whatever this is, what are we in a shed?
In a garage, yeah.
I wouldn't be in this garage talking to you if they hadn't been exactly the parents that they were.
A big payoff.
And what a, yeah, what a dream. What a dream. I mean, I could have been happy, but how lovely to be here.
So, like, you really consider that moment at 13 the day you started stand up? Because it wasn't
conscious at the time, but now that I, you know, if I look back at the dates, I think, oh, well, that's strange that those two things happened at the same time.
Do you remember, what you talked about?
I was a really weird. It was a combination of stealing some stuff from those shows, from like these weird Canadian comedians, and also like writing some stuff that was so that was like really out of character.
But you were 13.
Yeah, I mean, well, in contrast to who I am now, I suppose. I mean, there were jokes about environmentalists being a bit, like, smelly. Like it's, like, really weird opinions to
13-year-old opinions.
Yeah, like, but it's like, why... It was like, there was a thing about these environmentalists who care more about recycling their toilet paper than actually using it. No, like, what is... Who's that guy?
It's a poop joke.
You give
the 13-year-old a break.
I suppose so. Yeah, but what was good is that there was some laughter for whatever reason, whether they just thought I was a weirdo or cute or something.
You're a kid.
And I like that. I like that sound.
And yeah. And did you? And when was the first time you started doing it in clubs?
18. Well, no, actually, before that, there were like a few different competitions. There was like a BBC New Comedy Awards competition, so I was like 17 when I entered that, and there were about maybe 10 gigs between 13 and 18.
Yeah.
And then at 18, I retired.
Yeah, good for you.
And then started again when I was 21.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah.
To go to college?
No, I got a job on a kid's cable channel, Nickelodeon.
Yeah.
Where I sort of introduced the Rugrats and stuff like that.
Oh, so you were the guy in between the shows.
Yeah.
Hey, kids.
Yeah.
You were a presenter of things.
Exactly, yes.
Reading the prompter.
And I thought, well, I'm introducing the Rugrats. I've made it. What do I need this stand-up nonsense for?
Isn't that interesting? Because I had a gig like that where, I had already been doing stand-up a while, but I got a job hosting something. I didn't want it. It was not my dream, but I wasn't making any money.
Right.
But I remember being furious that I wasn't being written jokes and that, like, you know, it wasn't funnier. I was like, come on, I got more than this. Didn't you feel that frustration? Like, I gotta, you know.
I did, and I got sacked in the end.
Because?
Because I kept trying to sort of be funny, and it didn't suit, you know, it wasn't right for the, you know.
Did you miss comedy? Were you in it for stand-up, or were you in it just for a gig? To get a gig
No,
like
I
that?
Love television. When I was a kid, it was really more television than stand-up for me.
Right.
I worshipped certain TV hosts in the UK.
Like who?
Chris Evans.
Uh-huh.
I was just in love with everything he did, The Big Breakfast, and then TFI Friday, and Don't Forget Your Toothbrush. And I loved him. And he was a weirdo. He was like, he looked like an oddball, and he commanded, these shows.
Mm-hmm.
And invented them, and, just thought he was really... he wasn't funny in the way a comedian is funny, but he was very natural and joyful and silly. And so the sort of the job linking the shows on Nickelodeon was quite similar to the way The Big Breakfast worked. You had I loved all the paraphernalia. You got a clipboard and you got an earpiece.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a floor manager that you saw saying 5, 4, 3, 2, you know, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe that I was there doing it at 18. And then what happened? And then I also loved hosts who were a bit sarcastic and a bit cheeky with the guests.
Yeah.
And that didn't go down too well.
On Nickelodeon.
No. And so they said, you can't be here anymore.
Did you have guests on that show?
Yeah, like pops. I got banned from interviewing the pop stars and, because they were terrible. They were terrible.
Right.
Like bands, you know, these like real like cheesy horrific pop.
They were trying to cater to kids.
Yeah,
right?
I know right now.
And then,
but
didn't you go on to more hosting gigs?
Thankfully, there was then a pop show.
Yeah,
on Channel 4 that needed a sarcastic presenter.
Which one?
It was called Pop World. It was on Channel 4 and it ran for like 5 years.
So, oh, really? So you were on for 5 years,
yeah,
but you were, and then you started doing stand up again during that.
Because I felt like, oh, we've sort of got a good vibe. It was myself and a girl called Makita Oliver, and we had a very like a good chemistry together. But I thought the show could be funnier.
Yeah,
and I think the way to make it funnier is if I find out that, you know, figure out how to be funny again, and I started doing stand up again.
Because when I actually didn't meet you, but the first time that I was aware of you was I was doing a show downstairs. Or was it downstairs in the Soho Theater? And you were doing one upstairs.
Yes.
And you were packing them out. I just remember there were people there, like girls were lining up and like you were very popular. And I remember like, who's that guy? And I remember someone told me like, oh, he had a show on TV and the teenagers love him.
And what did you think? Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. I'm like, he's not even a comic.
He's not a comic. Yeah. Just some teenage girls. I'm fine then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then I feel great.
Yeah. Just some cute guy that's doing a thing.
Well, I'm thrilled to be called a cute guy, so I'm just happy with that.
When was that? It was only a few years ago. Do you remember that, when you did some stuff at the Soho?
I think it might have been, it might have been some work in progress that probably led towards the Numb show in the end. But it was a struggle for me because I mean,
because you did have that reputation on television as being a certain guy.
Yeah, and I didn't want to be sarcastic and cheeky on stage and stand up. I wanted to figure out who I was. I wanted to deal with what was going on in my life.
Right.
So it turned out to be a bit more sensitive and a bit more thoughtful.
It's hard to make that jump.
Yeah, especially if people are expecting something different.
Did you were willing to risk losing a couple?
Yeah, because also my heroes were people who were really, like, people like Daniel Kitson and Stuart Lee would say things on stage like, they're just, you know, they're not trying to build their audiences, they're trying to sort of narrow them down to, like, the right people.
Yeah.
And that's why I really went with that. But I think too much.
I don't think so. I mean, I think I've talked to Stuart when I was in England,
yeah,
and he's great. I mean, the reason he quit stand-up and then, you know, the way... You know, his attitude about it changed coming back, mm-hmm, was fairly empathetic, because that is a big, you know, for a guy like him who was hammering away for a long time with a very specific point of view, who eventually got, you know, angry at people who didn't understand him to the point where he had to split, and then to come back and then realize, like, well, it's not their fault.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not what they signed. You know, this was not their idea of an entertaining evening. He said something very profound to me where he was looking out at somebody who wasn't understanding him and actually felt like, I'm sorry. There's nothing I'm going to do that's going to, you know, bring you, you know, into this. And yeah, you just made the wrong choice tonight, and we're just going to have to live with that.
That's so, yeah, it's peaceful, that, isn't it?
It kind of is.
I used to turn the, if there was a sort of older guy in the front row, he'd definitely be my father that night. You know, do a load of stuff. I mean, he wouldn't be my father, but I'd make
sit in.
Father.
Yeah.
You know, I'd do a whole,
yeah.
And they're just people.
Yeah.
They're just people coming for a nice time.
Right. And not unlike the parents thing you said, a lot of times, when they seem to not be paying attention, who the fuck knows what their day was like?
Yeah.
I've been to shows. I mean, you're going to sit at a show and okay, that was funny. And then maybe you're going to be like, I got to do that thing tomorrow. What? Oh, you know, like you're going in and out of whatever the hell your life
is. Or I've fallen asleep in the front row of shows in Edinburgh because I was really tired. And you know what? And the before must be a terrible rejection.
Yeah.
But I was just tired. I shouldn't have sat in the front row.
Yeah.
But horrible.
Yeah. Kitson's he's an interesting thing. He won't talk to me, but he doesn't like
he won't talk to you
on a mic. You know, he's a very principled person.
What do you think the principle is?
Well, they're his. I don't know that they're, you know, there's not like a book of Kitson principles, but I think that, you know, he has, you know, he clearly has, whether he call it an aesthetic vision for himself or not. I mean, he's got a way he's going to do things, and that's all there is to it.
Yeah. He's got a perfect life in terms of his career.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to worry about any of the external nonsense that other people have to worry about.
He's a pure comic, a pure stage performer, right? He doesn't do TV really. He does some spots on TV, but he's not looking for a TV job. You know, he is what he is.
Yeah. And it's,
how would you explain, cause a lot of, my audiences probably don't know him, and they're not going to hear him on here because he won't do it. And there's a limited, amount of stuff they can watch of his. He's really like a pure live performer. Either you're going to see him live or that's it. Right?
Yeah. And sometimes like really late at night.
Yeah.
Or really early in the morning. I mean, he does everything he can so you don't come and see him.
he's almost a savant-like person.
He's annoying.
Yeah.
He's just annoying.
Yeah. Funny though, right?
Oh no, he's great. He's the best.
I saw him do almost like the last time I was in England. I saw him do a play. It wasn't really stand up, but it was there was a story to it.
Was it him sat behind a table?
No, it was about I can't even remember exactly what it was, but it had to do with finding a manuscript of some kind by somebody, and he built it was definitely a theatrical monologue.
Yeah.
That wasn't stand up. That was based on a fictional character, I think, that he created, who was a writer. And it was fairly dense in a way, because he's a very multi-leveled guy, but it certainly wasn't stand-up. And it was challenging. I mean, it was challenging content-wise, you know, because you're sitting there like, well, is this a comedy? Is it not a comedy? It was very thoughtful and I think a little bit experimental, but I definitely respected him for that.
I think what's good about him,
yeah,
is that, and what I'm a bit jealous of,
yeah,
apart from his talent, is that he isn't interested in show business.
Right.
Really only interested in what he gets up to on that stage.
Yeah, no, I agree.
I grew up kind of loving things on television, and I was just in New York, and a friend of mine, his father was directing a film that Morgan Freeman and Diane Keaton were in.
Oh,
and
really?
I got to be on the set of that film, and it was thrilling.
Yeah.
Like, not just thrilling because those people are names, but I got to see them act. I got to see take two, take three.
Yeah.
I got to see how they do what they do.
Yeah.
And this is it's a thrilling show business moment in my life.
Yeah.
And if you have the desire to be part of show business, then there's a whole load of other shit that goes on with what we're up to here.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of marketing that has to go on. There's appearances and there's talking to people and there's a whole load of stuff.
Yeah.
And you know, you want to write a thing for television. You want to write a film. And so I'm jealous that he doesn't have any of those desires, seemingly.
Right. And he's at peace with it.
He's at peace, but he can just make his thing.
Yeah.
But it's annoying, you know. It's annoying because I feel like I drive myself insane all the time about what should I be doing this? Should I be, is this still art? You know,
yeah.
All this sort of stuff. And you know, he's over there and he's fine.
He's
also going to really enjoy us talking about him.
Right. Well, good. I know exactly what you're talking about.
You know what I mean?
The barometer of integrity. He is. You know, he is the precedent that, you know, like, you know, none of us can attain Kitsonhood.
The truth is, he's the biggest egomaniac of all of us.
Right.
Maybe not more than you.
Well, I think that's true on some level because, like, you know, he's doing exactly what he wants to do and he's respected for that.
Yeah.
And he is able to be humble with it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the other things don't even enter his mind. He doesn't want to do it.
But I think I'm working harder.
Maybe that's true. maybe I'm not on the specific things that he is, but yes, you... Well, what is it that you want, ultimately? I mean, you're here, you're in town to do the radio ab thing?
Yeah, that's why I was in Texas.
So you're touring with Jed.
A little bit, just four shows.
Uh-huh.
And I'm doing a couple of spots here and there and, you know, various high-powered meetings.
Right.
So that I can make it in this town.
Yeah, well, that's it. So, you know, like, it's hard for British comics. In a way, because there's a handful of them that have found success here, and then there's a lot that don't, you know, either come or don't click. So it must be an extra added bit of challenge to sort of appeal to American audiences and find your way.
I found it easier actually when I was in New York last year doing 7 weeks. It was like a residency at this small theater in St. Mark's.
Yeah.
I found it easier, actually. It was easier being this new guy that people were excited to see than when I went straight to Edinburgh afterwards and then had that whole thing of, oh, do these people like me for this? But, you know, I had a load of stuff that I was making up in my head.
Right, you're the new guy here.
Yeah, it was just lovely to be the new guy. It's really exciting to be this strange new person.
And what about that? The idea of themed shows, because that's not an American thing, and that is sort of, I think, something that came out of Edinburgh, is that, like, every year you go back, you've got to name your hour.
Yeah.
And you've got to think, you know, is it a story, is it not a story? I imagine that sometimes those shows are not necessarily theatrical pieces as much as a way to frame stand-up. Like, what were the different themes of your shows as each year went by? Like, what was the first show you did at Edinburgh?
Gosh. Well, the first one that was named was called No Self.
And what was that about? What was the angle?
That was about this sort of Buddhist idea that we need to get beyond illusory attachments, labels, anything you think, this is me, I am this, you know, I'm this guy in these clothes, anything that was kind of made up.
And
I was trying to figure out who I was beyond all those things.
And were you able to do that? Did you try that stuff? I mean, did you try to sort of move the ego aside to get at the true kernel of Simon-ness? We'd have to lose Simon.
No Simon, no names.
Yeah.
No names. I think actually it was, I think it probably wasn't as funny as it could have been.
Uh huh.
Looking back, I think it was a bit silly.
But did you engage in those meditation practices? Did you try to do that stuff?
I think at the time I was more theoretical, and now I practice meditation. Now I'm more into the actual work of it rather than...
Well, didn't you tell a story in the show about some sort of retreat? Am I remembering properly?
In Nome, I spoke about going to Peru, yeah.
What was that about?
You actually
went to Peru?
Yeah.
And what was the reason?
To drink ayahuasca.
Oh, so this is a hallucinatory journey.
It was, yeah.
So what happened? I mean, you don't have to do the bit word for word, but I you know, I've read about that. I know William Burroughs was into it. Mm. Castaneda was into it.
Yeah.
I knew, but I never sought it out. But back in the days when I did do drugs, but you got compelled by who? What spurred you on to say, like, I'm going to try that? Was it for material, or were you really looking for something?
No, I was really, I was just inspired by an old school friend who, at a dinner we had, told this story about going to this place. And as he's told this story, he looked like an 8-year-old boy. Like, he was just so full of joy.
Yeah.
And, just how he'd been sort of healed, I suppose, by this medicine. They were sort of keen to call it a medicine rather than a drug, because otherwise it gets lumped in with things like cocaine and all this sort of stuff that isn't very helpful at all.
Sure.
And this has been used by the indigenous people for thousands of years to heal them. It's medicine.
But
it's
did you think you needed to be healed of? I mean, what were you hitting some sort of bottom with yourself?
Yeah, I'd been in therapy for about 2 years. I felt like it was very helpful, but it felt like there was something that I couldn't resolve. Like, there was some sort of hidden memory that I couldn't get at.
Were you reset? Were you depressed or anxious?
Yeah, and
or?
I had so many appointments. So I was depressed, and every day there'd be another thing. There'd be, okay, go to the acupuncturist, go to the yoga, go to the osteopath. I looked at my diary and I thought, oh my, how broken do I think I am?
Right.
And it was quite broken.
Really? And how was it manifesting itself, though? I mean, what in your life was
not... Well, the show was called Numb because I stopped feeling anything. My defense mechanisms had become so strong that I'd protected my entire self against the whole world, anything that could happen.
Pain?
I was like, okay, well, I'd sorted life out so that I couldn't feel any pain, but then I couldn't feel.
So that's interesting because, like, I've had periods in my life where you're like, am I completely detached or am I evolved?
Right. Yes. I felt that because all the Buddhist teachings are about this is just a moment. This is not real. You know, this is not real. And I was like, oh yeah, Well, I'm not really feeling anything about that person dying, so I guess I'm a brilliant Buddhist.
Right. I'm living it.
Yeah. I mean, no, we're not.
No, you're not.
Yeah, we're not.
That's what you learned.
I was just numb, just totally numb. And, you know, because I don't drink alcohol or don't do drugs or anything, so there'd just be a lot of Ben and Jerry's ice cream and stuff.
Yeah, no, I'm there with you. Were you able to track, like, when it happened, or had you been feeling it your whole life? Did it evolve? Do you know, like, were you able to say, like, I've always been numb, or at some point, you know, something got hurt inside of me where I'm like, I'm done?
It's a bit personal, but in the second ceremony, there are four ceremonies, and in each one, you're sort of sat in a circle in darkness, and you drink this drink, and I found myself, like, in the womb. And then I found myself, you know, I sort of was aware of myself in the room with these people, but also as a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the pram. And then I sensed things that were going on. And I don't know what this is.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm just, I don't know what this is.
Yeah.
But I sensed things that were going on when I was a baby that I would not be able to remember and wouldn't be able to bring up in therapy.
Right.
And I resolved those during the ayahuasca ceremony. Huh. And then felt like... I wasn't broken anymore. Like,
really?
Felt like I was, and I thought, oh, yoga for just the joy of doing yoga.
Right.
At a moment where there was a moment where I talk about in the stand-up, like becoming a cat in the ceremony, and it all becomes quite primal, and you sort of remember that all these, like, that we're both guys here, sort of, you know, sat here in shirts, and you're wearing glasses, and you've made your beard like that, but we're just animals with spit and blood, and you know, we're just animals, really. And I sort of became a cat in this ceremony, and sort of, you know, really, like, I was like ferocious. I was and I'd always become like a timid sort of, okay, well, I guess I'm sort of like just a nice sort of like a nice sweet guy. I was a maniac cat guy in this thing, and sexual and.
Yeah,
all these things are a bit sort of embarrassing and a bit like, ugh, I can't be that guy. And so
but you were in it. You didn't.
I was in it. I was just. It wasn't. You know. It was just. It was natural, and I wasn't blocking any aspect of myself. I was able to be completely free.
Oh, okay.
So the yoga. Like, you know, I've got to do yoga because I'm like, my posture. And now then I had a moment where I thought, cats don't do yoga.
Yeah.
They just sort of stretch because they're cats.
Yeah.
And that sorts them out. And so that stayed with me, that idea that I'll just do that because of the joy of doing it, or, you know, just doing something not for the results, just for the joy of doing it. And it's really helped with everything. It's helped with the stand-up, to remember that I enjoy it. It's not to get anywhere. Even doing something like I did Letterman when I was in New York a few weeks ago.
I watched that. It was good.
Was that all right?
Well, it was interesting because, like, you had that, like, I'm very sensitive to you know, performers.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it makes sense what you're saying now, because there was a moment where when you stepped out there, you're like, I'm here.
Yeah.
You're like,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And, you know, I could feel that you connected, you know, that, like, I can identify that, because I tend to work like that, where I offer more of myself than might be safe necessarily, but it's worth it.
Right.
And some guys just go do their act. And I knew you were doing stuff that you had planned, but there was definitely about 30 seconds where you were like, just you. And that's it's a tremendous risk, but the rewards of that are great, because then people are listening to you in a different way. You know, you're not just a guy reeling off jokes, but you're like this person that's having this moment. And that's the best you can really hope for.
That's very nice of you to say. Thank you. That's good. Yeah, but it was terribly overwhelming.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I had to go there 2 days before just to sort of be in the theater. Just because
right,
I thought I'm going to be too nervous.
Are you a fan of Letterman?
Yeah, I love
him. The best, right? Yeah.
The best.
Yeah.
And stole so much from him when I was on those shows hosting.
Oh, really? Just tactics?
I just did him for a while. And so it was very strange to be there. And I was ready, you know, because I thought, I'm just going to... Because you can think about... There's so much that go through your head with something like that, because it feels like it's a career move, and it's a, you know, it's a big rite of passage, and it's a, you know, all this nonsense.
Yeah.
And I thought, let's just... What about if we just enjoyed this 5 minutes?
Did you?
Well. Maybe I enjoyed 1 minute. I certainly found some joy in there.
But it's a very heightened moment, that, because I feel the same way about him, and I remember my first time... You know, the great thing about it is that you are in a genuine theater. You know, you're not in a TV studio. So there is that moment where, you know, you want to try to remember that there are cameras there. But, you know, just by nature of being a performer or a stand up, you're like, well, I'm in a theater.
Yeah.
A little further back than I should be. But I, you know, there's an audience there,
yep.
And they're hot. You know, they're ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And, but you work that 4.5 minutes, man. I mean,
yeah.
You know, like, you're like, it's hard for guys like us who do fairly long form stuff to isolate. You know, enough beats to do 4.5.
And it's a strange thing to do. To go, like, it's already a comedy show.
Yeah.
So for him to then go, and now some stand-up comedy, it's like, what for?
But it's established. I mean, yeah.
I couldn't figure out why I was there.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I mean? I couldn't figure out, like, as I walked out.
You're overthinking that.
Yeah, I suppose.
You were there to do stand-up.
Yeah, I know, but I think that it shouldn't ever look like that.
Yeah.
There should always be something that it's, like when I did this show called Nevermind the Buzzcocks in the UK, and that was like a pop show that, you know, it was a comedy show pretending to be a pop
show. You know, they
show.
Tried that here.
With you, right?
Yeah.
With you.
Yeah,
but you killed it. You made it so it would never work again.
I did, yeah. Not on purpose. I just didn't quite, I don't think I fully understood the game, and I'm not sure that...
No, I never did either. I did it for 3 years, and I was always like, this is such a stupid game. Why are we doing this?
Well, that, I think that's one of the reasons it didn't work, aside from the fact that I was not in a good place in my life when I got that.
Right.
I needed money. I don't know that I would have taken the job otherwise, and I'm not sure I was the right guy to do it, but I don't know that Americans really gravitate towards games without stakes. Like it's really just an improvisational comedy show in the framework of a game show that's
exactly.
Based on pop music, and I just don't think if there's no money changing hands, and there's, you know, there were just no stakes to it.
No,
and yeah, I think we did some funny stuff, but there was a whole shift going on with that network. It just didn't work. Thank God.
Did it hurt when I said that you ruined it?
No, I knew I did.
No, I was just joking. I never saw it. I was just joking.
Well, I don't know that I ruined it, but I don't know that I was really...
You know what? I think it's there's a culture in this country of the talk shows.
Yeah.
And there's a culture in the UK of those panel shows. And I think that maybe it just doesn't... We don't really have those 5 nights a week talk shows.
Right.
And you don't really have those panel shows.
Is that what it's called? It's a panel show.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Like, there's some of them now. They kind of come and go. Like Hardwick's doing one, and where it's framed as a game show, but it's not. There's no stakes. It's just for fun.
But what I'm saying is, Mark,
yes,
there's nothing you could have done. It's not your fault.
Thank you for letting me off the hook. Are you speaking for your entire country?
It's not your fault.
Okay.
It's not your fault.
Thank you. Thank you. But it kind of was...
It's not your fault.
Okay.
There's nothing you could have done, Mark.
Okay, okay.
You were just a child.
I know. You're right, it wasn't my fault. I was a child.
Yeah.
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 I couldn't have known.
You couldn't have done anything different to what you did.
Yeah, that's true.
You did what you knew how to do.
That's exactly right.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's an important lesson in real life.
Huge, huge.
That, you know, like, know your limitations and also, you know what you can and can't do. And then don't do something, then beat yourself up. Because I used to do that. I don't know if you do this. I do things where, you know, I couldn't have done it any differently. I think I do things to beat myself up for.
Oh.
Do you ever do that? Would you? I'm
like
just
what?
Hard
like,
on myself.
Go on, talk to me. Talk to me about what?
Like, I make decisions in my life where, like, it's sort of like, well, I probably shouldn't have done that. And I do it knowing, going into it, that I shouldn't do it. And then when I do it, I'm like, well, it was okay. But, like, I still pick at it. Like, I'm just realizing this because I just got out of a relationship that, you know, I'm very hard on myself. And when you're in a relationship, you just let the other person be hard on you. And, you know, you're so engaged with their issues that you don't think of it. And then when you get out, you're like, oh, my God, I'm still insecure. I still have, you know, I'm still a little hard, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because
it's
difficult being alive, isn't it?
For some people.
No, I think for everyone. And some people sort of hide it.
Or
one has a podcast where they bang on about it.
That's right. That's right. But I think it is easier for some people because they've done some of the stuff that we're talking about. They've accepted something.
But then it's almost harder because you beat yourself up because you think, oh, I know this.
Yeah.
I know. How did I do that again?
Well, can you identify that moment where you said you realized that, you know, when you were in the womb or wherever that, you know, where you,
it just sounds ridiculous.
No, it's not ridiculous. I mean, but can you identify what exactly got shaken loose to enable you the freedom that you now have, the comfort or the idea that was it basically like, you know, stop taking everything so seriously, you know, be present, you know, what?
No, it was, okay. If you don't mind me being a slightly vague,
mm-hmm.
I witnessed as that baby during this experience, this ceremony,
mm-hmm.
Being present for something going on between my mother and father,
mm-hmm.
that the baby version of me felt like it needed to do something to stop it from happening.
Right.
Then something in the ayahuasca, because it acted like a sort of therapeutic conversation for me. I don't know if it acts like that for everyone else, mm-hmm. but it acted like therapy for me, probably because I'd just been doing 2 years of therapy and mm-hmm. that was the language. It said to me, like I just said to you jokingly, you were just a child. There's nothing. You couldn't even crawl, it said.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't even crawl.
Mm-hmm.
And I start crying and I realize I forgive the baby. I forgive the baby.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this great release.
Wow.
And then because so many connections got made, you know, when I felt that baby, feeling what was going on in that room, everything tensed, my stomach tensed, my shoulders rounded,
uh-huh.
I had very bad posture and was very shy as a child. Everything seemed to make sense
mm-hmm.
from that point. Now, I might just be making it all up, and it might just be that whatever happens in that medicine just gives you what you need to know, you know, in order to sort of let you get to the next stage. But everything seemed to make sense, and I thought, oh, I'm fine.
Right.
I'm fine, actually.
Yeah.
Nothing's wrong.
But that moment, that whatever that shame moment was, had defined a good part
yes.
of your
yeah,
your
it made me sh-
being.
It made me feel like I couldn't go to parties as a kid. I couldn't leave my mother. I used to grab onto my mother's leg.
Yeah.
You know, it made me feel like I needed to protect and save and fix and it was a nonsense. It was a false perception
right.
that I had as a baby. You know,
and that had been ingrained in your wiring,
yeah,
deep,
completely unconscious, and so after that, there was a freedom. There was a feeling like I wasn't, that I wasn't broken, and that
self acceptance.
Yeah, self acceptance. Yeah, yeah, I suppose all that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's fucking great.
Yeah, it feels good, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And then I have to remember it, though, because I still I slip in and out of, you know, there are still moments, obviously, when I still feel like, oh God, why. But why get out of bed and do what for?
Right.
You know, and then, you know, the worst sentence is, and then what?
Right.
Because once you've done some stuff, Like, this may be the opposite of your story, really, because your story is really that there were opportunities that you missed when you were younger and that now it's all sort of happening for you, right?
Kind of. But I mean, no, I know exactly what you're talking about is that, like, that you have to fight meaninglessness.
You have to fight meaninglessness. Exactly. And why I mention that is because my story was that, I was working since I was 18 and there was this pop show and this comedy show and they made a sitcom and doing lots of stand up and things and a special and another special. And, I always feel like, even at the start of an Edinburgh festival of a month long festival, you know, you build up to this hour long show. And then after the first night of the month, if that was a film,
yeah,
you know, the credits would roll after that first night. You're bowing, yeah, the applause, yeah, credits roll, but it's not. You then have to do it again for 29 nights.
Oh my God.
And you think, well, what? And it's always, and then what? And you think, and when I made the sitcom that we did in the UK, I thought, well, that's just going to be it. That's going to be the thing. Right. And then I can retire.
Right. Retire to what, though?
I don't know, but I just thought I'm tired.
Yeah.
It's exhausting writing that thing and acting and, you know, editing the thing. And I thought, I'm just going to, but then people say, well, what are you up to at the moment? I just did a,
I just did a thing. Yeah.
It's on DVD.
Yeah. I'm in the middle of this right now. Because I'm doing the second season of my TV show.
Right.
And you're just sort of like, I did one. It was.
I did one.
Yeah.
Yeah. If we were in a tribe and we were the people who brought the berries.
Yeah.
People would say thank you for the berries. They wouldn't go, oh, any more berries coming up?
Well, maybe
they don't eat those berries.
Yeah. But you brought them, so you need to bring us more.
Yeah.
You're the guy who knows how to get the berries.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Yeah, but it's a ridiculous complaint, though, isn't it? Because what a joy to do this and all that stuff. But it's hard sometimes.
But it's still work. I mean, work is work. And then, but that whole idea of, like, I haven't experienced it, you know, until recently, because I'm no longer in a relationship, mm-hmm, where, you know, I'm just sitting with myself and you're just sort of like, what's the fucking point of all this?
How long was the relationship for?
3.5 years.
Well, that's a long time.
But I've been through this before. I mean, but I don't know, because you'd want to identify it as depression, right? But I don't think it is depression. I think it is some sort of, being overwhelmed. Like I feel that whatever I would identify as depression is just this weird anxiety that gets to such a pitch, mm-hmm, to where I'm exhausted.
Right.
You know, things are very simple and there are some joys in life that don't revolve around eating ice cream and jerking off. You know what I mean? I know it's
Name them.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, I've been told.
Yeah.
You know, but you still battle with that on some level. You still sort of like one day you wake up and you're like, ugh.
It's just where the thinking part of us is overdeveloped and the feeling part of us is underdeveloped.
Okay.
To be really simplistic about it.
I think
we're just thinking too much.
Yeah.
Cats just wandering around, eating and shitting.
Right, right.
I mean, if we just, all the things that we have to think about,
yeah,
as human beings, like, yeah, the ambition, the competition.
It's
and
crazy.
I mean, it's madness.
Yeah.
And we've got the internet.
Oh, no.
I mean, cats don't have the internet. It's easier.
It's much easier. Sure. It's much easier. Yeah. And they don't have that forward thinking, yeah, really. They don't have recollection that is, yeah, vivid. Yeah.
I think what you have to do is, and I think this is why religion exists probably,
yeah,
is because you have to then put rules in place. So you don't do things like wake up and get straight onto the laptop and checking your emails. So you have to meditate first. If I don't meditate for 3 days, get quite grumpy.
Do you?
Yes.
So how often do you meditate?
Like every morning.
Like for how long?
20 minutes. It's become a bit looser since going to Peru. It's become a bit of a looser experience for me. It's become a bit more weird and primal.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
What's your process? I mean, if you were going to tell me, okay, Mark, you need to start meditating. Here's what you do to start.
Find a nice seating position.
Yeah.
And don't do anything other than be aware of what's going on. Close your eyes and just be aware of the sounds, maybe.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And don't try to, and things will, then thoughts come up.
Yeah.
Don't try to get rid of those thoughts.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not an expert, but don't try and get rid of those thoughts. Just go, oh, there's a thought.
Yeah.
Okay. Then, yeah, it goes.
Yeah.
Then something, oh, memory. Oh, uh-huh. Okay. There it goes.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the sound from traffic. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then what that does is it's not just for the sake of that. It then trains your brain.
Uh-huh.
So the next time, let's say you're in an argument or something comes up, then you go, oh, it's just a person saying those words.
Yeah.
And then everything's fine. Oh, okay.
Right.
That's, yeah. Or whatever it is. Oh, okay. Well, that's Letterman. Okay. I'll go and do a spot on Letterman. Oh, okay.
This will be over soon.
This will be over soon. Yeah. Yeah, no, you got to be in the moment.
No, right. That's
the
true.
Key.
Oh, that's true. That's
yeah,
true.
That's the worst. I got up this morning. I'm doing three things today, and this is the middle one.
Yeah.
You know, part of me goes, you know, because I'm a bit tired. I think, oh, I'll just get today done. And then there'll be tomorrow. But I thought, you know? Yeah. And then I thought, what about enjoy today?
Yeah.
What about really enjoy doing this podcast with Mark Maron? Well, that's a fun thing to do.
Right. Do you have dread? I have dread sometimes.
Do you have dread? I have dread. It's so funny. This whole situation is so funny.
But that's what you're talking about, like with the tomorrow thing.
You're
anytime you're, not so much like that, but it's like, all right, well, this is fun. We're doing this, but like, oh, fuck, in 2 hours I have to. Okay. You know, it's not like, oh no, but it's sort of like, you start going through it in your head and then you just have to stop that.
Yeah.
Because your brain will just manufacture shit for you to freak out about.
Mm. Because that's what it's that, what's that thing? That thing that everyone always talks about, that, fight or flight.
Sure. Thing. Sure. You gotta be ready.
Gotta be ready. But what's happening? There's no bear in the room.
Yeah, no, that's not.
There's no bear in the room.
There's a bear inside though. There's a bear right inside my head.
Mm. Is there though?
Are you doing stand-up?
I think you've made it up.
Though. Yeah, probably.
We make up that.
I'm gonna have to go to sit with some ayahuasca and kill the bear. Yeah, kill the bear.
They say it's a calling, the ayahuasca thing.
Yeah, I think those days are behind me. I'm gonna have to do it some other way.
Why they say? Oh, because you're an addict.
Yeah, I don't do it anymore.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's actually got counter-addictive qualities in that it tastes more disgusting the more times you drink it. And it heals people of their addiction.
I heard that. I think it is true.
I've got a friend who's an addict, and I was talking to him about it, and he said it's just, you know, it's just a risk. It's just too much of a risk for him.
Yeah, because it'll just open the door to like, oh, if I can put that in my mouth and have those feelings, why not do what I used to do?
I think it wouldn't, though. I think there's a real difference between that and any other drug that I'm really aware of.
Sure.
It's not like a fun trip. It's not like and they go, woo, what a night.
Yeah.
It's horrific.
Yeah. And you had to take it how many times?
Four times. Yeah.
And was the cat on the fourth time?
Cat was on the fourth time, yeah.
So that's good. So it worked. I mean, by after the third time, you were like, I'm not quite a...
there was a feeling like I was reborn in the second... Nothing happened in the first ceremony because I was so...
freaked
stuck
out.
In my
yeah.
head and trying to control it. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as I surrendered to it in the second ceremony, things started happening. And then the third ceremony, I can't really remember what happened, but I guess nothing much because I can't remember. And then in the fourth ceremony, so it was like I was reborn in the second one, and in the fourth one, I became a man.
Reborn in the third one.
Sorry, reborn in the second one. And then the fourth one became like a man.
Yeah.
Became like somebody who was able to just sort of be in a room, you know?
Yeah,
Like men.
Own yourself.
Yeah, I was a... Yeah, I mean, there's
a lot.
There's a lot of stories in Numb. All I think of is the stories that are in Numb now.
Yeah,
but yeah.
Yeah, a man among men.
A man among looking out for other people.
Uh huh.
You know, like yeah. I remember, I mean, this is a podcast, so nobody can see, but you'll be able to see. So normally, I'm sort of like you describe
fold
how
it
I
up.
Look.
Yeah,
fold
a little
it up.
Crouched.
And I'm just hopefully everything's going to be all right.
Yeah.
And I found myself sat. Like, legs open.
Yes.
And, like, leaning forward and, like, looking around, going, okay, you okay?
Yeah.
All right, let's do this. Are you okay? Is everyone all right? Okay, come on then. Let's go.
You're a leader.
A leader, right? Yeah. And then pointing to, like, this attractive guy.
Yeah.
To the side of me.
Yeah.
And then sort of, like, telling him, come to me.
Oh,
come to me. Like that madness.
Yeah.
And I normally, in a sort of social setting, I'm like, oh, I can't possibly talk to that person. He's, you know, that's why I'll be such a creep. I'm like, come to me.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
How'd that feel?
It felt amazing, and he did come, and he had a lovely time. Yeah.
Did any of that stick with you?
Yeah, not as much as it should have done. But yeah, a little bit. I mean, I'm in a relationship now, but...
How long?
2 years.
Oh, really?
It's great.
Is it?
Sorry to say that after
you've just broken up
with someone.
It's okay.
It's terrible.
No,
it's terrible. You're better off on your own with your guitars.
No, I'm not. I need to be for a little while. You know how that goes.
Yeah.
Got to reprocess. 2 years, that's good. That's long.
Yeah, it's the longest. I've just broken my record of being in a relationship.
Is he in the show business?
No.
Good.
The opposite.
Oh, good.
What's the opposite of show business?
Reality?
Economics.
Oh, really? Interesting. Yeah, yeah. It's good to be with somebody who's not caught up in this crap.
I think so. Yeah, I've been with show business people before, and it's. I think it's a difficult. You know, it's enough one person having. You know. It's just too much. It's just too much self-awareness.
Too much self-awareness, and also there's, you know, the undercurrent of competition and ego, sort of like, you know, how come you got that? When did, you know, when am I going to get this? And what?
Difficult.
What's a good relationship? I mean, what do you think makes it good?
I think honesty, right?
Yeah.
I think just talking.
Yeah.
Just talking. Just being unafraid to say the thing that you're worried makes you sound like a terrible person.
Yeah.
And then you say it out. It's like sort of stand up. That's why I love stand up.
Yeah.
It's because I can say these things that I think are shameful and embarrassing, and then people laugh, and it feels like they're saying, not only is that funny, but we feel that too. And thank you for saying it, because now we don't feel as ashamed and embarrassed.
Yeah, you release something.
Yeah, and it's I think the same in a relationship. To be able to say something that you think is immoral or is inappropriate, and then the other person says, "Oh yeah, of course, because we're both human beings.
Right.
That's why you're feeling that.
Yeah, that's why.
Phew. Okay, good. So you're not gonna, you don't think you're not going to leave me? Yeah. Okay, good. Phew.
Oh, that's great. So yeah. What are you hoping to?
And the sex.
Sex, very important. Yeah.
Yeah.
that's got to stay good.
That has to be nice. Yeah. Sorry, what are you saying?
What are you hoping will happen here in the States for you?
Well,
in the big picture.
The healthy part of me.
Yeah.
Says, hey, this bit right now is just great.
Yeah.
What day is it today? Saturday? Sunday?
Sunday, yeah.
Sunday afternoon with Marc Maron in his shed. What a dream.
Yeah.
And then and we're doing some stand-up this week. That's good. People will come and laugh and, good.
Yeah.
Great, and then I'll go home.
Yeah.
And the unhealthy part of me goes, we have to be Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
Why aren't you Tom Hanks? Well, everyone loves Tom Hanks. They don't all love you. Why don't they all love you? What's wrong with you? How can you make them
How
love
can you,
you
be more like Tom
oh
Hanks?
Oh, my God. Why? You'll never be like Tom Hanks.
So you'd like to do movies?
Yeah, everything, I think. I mean, I'm into...
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up watching television, going to see films.
Have you done films?
Done one very low budget film, and I really enjoyed doing it. Yeah.
Yeah. And the series that you have in the UK is it's just available on DVD now? Or?
Yes, we did two seasons.
How many is that? 20?
Oh no.
12?
12.
Oh God, that's the best way to do it.
Yeah.
And now
even that felt like too much.
Well, explain to me how that works. I talked to Simon Pegg about it, but was it your choice to not do more, or how does it?
I felt like I wrote it with somebody, but I suppose it was based on more of my pain than his, and I felt like I'd written all the pain out of me, and anything any more would be gratuitous.
Right.
Like we could have done a third season or series, but it would have just been for the sake of entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like it would get too broad and silly.
And no one tried to muscle you into doing more? Was it successful?
I suppose it was a sort of cult hit, maybe, is probably the right way to say it.
What was it called?
Grandma's House.
Uh-huh.
And it was probably a bit too depressing to sort of reach, an enormous amount of people.
Right.
But the people, when people come up to me and they say they watched it and they like it, it's a very personal response, you know.
Right.
It's like I had an aunt like that, or
right.
You know, it's like,
right.
Oh my God, you really got that. Thank you. You know, it's that sort
it's the best. That's
it's
the best.
The best thing.
That's the best. But you're sort of in a tricky place with the hunger of your ego and the sort of
The ego wants, you know, but actually the truth is, and then what I have to remember is that I've left shows each time when they've got a bit too popular.
Uh-huh.
Partly because I think, now it's going to just turn to hate, so I better get out of here quick.
On your part, you're going to hate them. Or they're
going to
hate you?
Like, the story has been told that this is a good show. That's been out there.
Right.
That's what people are saying. So if I just stay here, at some point they're going to start saying,
it used to
be good.
Yeah.
So partly I get out of it. But partly also, certainly with the panel show, it was a bit too... It was a bit too much. It was a bit too impersonal. People coming up to me and sort of liking it and for things that I felt like weren't the best bits of it.
Right.
And it became, and I thought, I've got to, this is not, I don't think I'm expressing the truth of who I am in
right.
this
it becomes
in this format.
It becomes a job.
Yeah.
Too.
And also like not, you know, I like being, I really like being the new boy.
Yeah.
I like being here because I'm the new boy.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, well, I've done that. I was the new boy for the first season of that, and I didn't really know what I was doing, and it was exciting and fun. And now I sort of know what I'm doing now. People have expectations, and it's for me to carry on being how I've been so far. And I thought, okay, let's be the new boy in sitcoms now.
Yeah.
And then when that was, then I thought if we do a third season of this, it's, no one's going to go, oh, that's surprising.
Yeah.
It's like the last
right.
season.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a shame, really, that I don't just, because once I learn how to do something, I stop doing it. It's a shame I can't just keep going.
Yeah, I
it could be better for the audience.
I know, I feel I can definitely relate to that, because then it becomes a different challenge. It becomes a challenge of like, consistency. And sort of like figuring out what works about that version of you, and how many times can you hit that thing?
Yeah, and I don't want to. I think, and with stand up as well. As soon as you, as soon as it's sort of branded, like I don't know how you feel about this. Like I've been promoting this, the DVD of Numb in the UK, and I think it'll be on. I think it will be available in America in some sort of internet form. I'm not sure which
Netflix
thing.
Or something.
One of those kind of things at some point. But I've been promoting it and. You know, they ask what it's about, and I've been keep saying the word depression. I keep saying, you know, these words, and there's a concern that because I don't feel those things as strongly as I did before. I don't want to now that I don't want to be like, oh yeah, oh, so you're the sad guy.
Yeah.
You know that.
Oh yeah, it's tricky. It's tricky how to like, because people are like, yeah, I think you'd be a little bit more upbeat about how you're presenting it.
Yeah.
it's about rising above depression and having a rebirth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nobody really wants to hear it, you know, when you say that. Anyway.
It's hard when you're a thinky kind of comic because, like, if you actually are, if someone describes you or you describe yourself, a lot of people, if they don't know, you're like, wow, that doesn't sound like a fun time.
Yeah. Exactly.
But
yeah.
It is a fun time.
But it is. People are laughing.
Yeah,
at the
we're moving through things.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're helping the world.
We're trying, aren't we? We're trying. But I think what was my point? I had some sort of point about once you brand something, once you name something, it disappears a bit. It doesn't really exist anymore.
I think that's true. Yeah, I think it's because it's no longer about you. It's about that thing.
Because we're constantly changing and evolving and all those things, and you can't really, you know, once you name something,
yeah,
it's like, oh, so you're that. That's what you are.
Yep.
Yeah, which is why God, you know, doesn't get, you're not supposed to name God. Because then it's
He knew what he was doing. It's become a hell of a brand.
Great marketing.
Yeah,
it's so good.
Amazing brand. No matter what. No matter how you slice it, God seems to be a very powerful brand in the world. It's good talking to you, man.
Is that all right? Will you edit that into something that sounds like a real human being?
You're definitely a real human being. You helped me out. I mean, I thought that was a good conversation.
You know, I'm just asking these things now because I don't want it to end.
I know. We can hang out for a little while longer. That's our show. I like that guy. I don't want to say I like that kid because he feels younger than me. He was younger than me. All right. Look, go to WTF Pod for all you WTF Pod needs. Oh, don't forget, my special Thinky Pain is available on Amazon and many other outlets. Yeah, go get Thinky Pain if you didn't get it on Netflix. You can get it now. You can own it. You can own it. Where you buy DVDs, it is available. How's that? I think I'm manic. I freaked out today. Panic, manic, panic. The two things that will guarantee send a fear to the very core of your being in the moment that you feel them are, what's that lump? I better Google it. And holy shit, what's going on with my bank statement? Am I a victim of identity theft? Those two things are the scariest things your brain can do to you. Cancer and identity theft. Panic City. Of course, I can get my panic up for just about anything. You know, if I can't decide on a pair of pants. Yeah. Going without today. Keep hitting that. Freaked out. Thought I was in an identity theft situation. Turns out, I don't really understand how online banking works. That's all. I didn't understand what that thing was on my statement, and boy, did I go someplace. I went first to, like, someone's ripping me off, who made a list of names, you know, judged them thoroughly, thought I knew people that I didn't, and not only that, they were criminals, was going to take legal action. Then I went to, like, the faceless person who was taking money from my account, and, you know, what else are they doing? What else am I going to find out? How is this going to go? It was a bad rabbit hole. Then I called the bank up, and the guy explained to me, no, that's a check you wrote. And I was like, oh, okay. That's a good thing. All right. Well, I'm glad I didn't email people and tell them that legal action was underway. And I guess I just lost probably 2 weeks off my life because of that stress. But appreciate your help, and I'm an idiot. Yep. All right, that's all. Boomer lives!